Sonny, I was just in Miami the other day, last weekend, and then again on Saturday.
Ooh.
And you were telling me that you like Miami.
I do. Yes, I went for the first time a few months ago, and I could see myself living there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful town. God knows the weather is better than here in the Washington area. You're in North Carolina, but I'm in Northern Virginia. My family and I went on a cruise, and our departure point was Miami. So it was lovely. And as it happens, we have the mayor of Miami, who is a presidential candidate, Francis Suarez, going to talk to us here in a second, because this is the Line Drive podcast. And we are now joined by the aforementioned Mayor Francis Suarez, mayor of the great city of Miami and the great state of Florida. Mayor Suarez, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be with you, Tim and Sonny, and I'm glad you had a good experience, recent experience in Miami. That's always a good way to start any podcast or any interview.
Yeah, we went to we of course, you'll probably roll your eyes at this. I don't know how locals feel about it, but I took my two little boys to Versailles, of course, for dinner,
Oh,
the
wow. You
Cuban
know them
restaurant.
well. We wouldn't roll our eyes at that at all. Of course not.
Okay, it's very much a tour. Like if you're in Philadelphia, which is my hometown, and you
Yeah.
say, "Oh yeah, we went to Pat's Steaks," the locals will go, you know, okay, because it's a tourist trap and the locals don't go there. I don't know what the situation is like for Versailles in Miami, whether locals go there or not.
We do go there, and I know the family well, and the family is one that we really care about because it's not just become like a restaurant that you go to when you want to get authentic Cuban food. It's also become sort of like a political hotspot where candidates go to, and anytime there's any rally or any sort of demonstration of pro-free Cuba, oftentimes that's sort of the epicenter. And they're very generous with the venue and letting people use it to express a pro-America, free Cuba stance. So it's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. So let's get right into this. You are the mayor of Miami and have been since what, 2017, correct? And now running for president, you've thrown your hat in the ring. Why? This is the you know, sort of the threshold question that everyone gets asked, but we're going to go ahead and do it. Why are you running for president?
Well, as you said, I've been mayor for 5 years in Miami. I was elected by 85% and reelected by close to 80%, and helped convert Miami-Dade County from a plus 30 for Democrats to a plus 10 for Republicans, plus 30 the year before in 2016, when the former president lost to Hillary Clinton by 30 points. He did much better against Biden 4 years later, where he lost only by 8. And then in the midterm, the Republicans won by 10 and 12 respectively. So, I believe that our policies in Miami have set Miami on a course to be one of the most prosperous cities in the country, if not in the world. And that same set of principles that have created that prosperity can be scaled nationally to create generational prosperity. And so for me, I feel that I'm unique in terms of what I offer. I wouldn't run if I felt that somebody else embodied the same sort of principles that I do and the same candidate profile that I have. Obviously, I'm young. Obviously, I'm Hispanic. Obviously, I'm an urban mayor. No other mayor is in the race. No other Hispanic is in the race. So I think I have a lot of qualities that are distinct, that are that offer voters a choice. And politics is about choices, right? Politics is about giving people contrasting choices and then asking them what do they think is better for their future. And I think I also think I have the unique qualities to deal with the major problems of this country, and I've demonstrated them already. Part of the campaign is expressing what that vision will look like for the future of our country and how my unique qualities can help solve some of those problems.
Well, Mr. Mayor, you clearly have done a wonderful job in Miami and you're very popular there. I was just wondering, how do you think your time as mayor has helped prepared you to go into this next level of politics to be president of the United States?
It's helped me in a variety of different ways. One is when I first became a public official, actually in 2009, I inherited a broken and bankrupt city. I mean, a lot of people don't remember what it was like after the real estate bubble burst. Cities like Miami lost 20% of their revenue in 1 year. So I had to balance a budget as a councilman with the similar percentage deficit that the federal government now has. So one of the things I would ask voters, is ask yourself what candidate in the field has ever cut a public sector budget. Just ask that question, because I think that is an important question for us to balance our budget, to deal with things like inflation, which is the number one issue in America, to deal with rising interest rates, to deal with Bidenomics, where the poor get poor, right? Bidenomics is the poor get poor. But for me, Bidenomics equals poor get poor, right? And more class warfare. Why? Because people who have their money in bank accounts, which is where most people have their money, most particularly people at the lower end of the spectrum, they don't have some of these investment opportunities other people do. They're losing purchasing power through inflation. And then when they want to borrow money to say to buy a house, it's at 7% now. So they're, you know, it's prohibitively expensive. So being a poor person under Bidenomics is not the kind of country that I would want to live in. And it's interesting because the Democrats are supposed to be for the marginalized and the poor. And we see that's not the case. So what I've done in Miami, which I think is a predicate for being the president, is first I've balanced our budget with 20% expenses over revenue. That's exactly what we have to do at the federal government right now. Secondly, I've lowered taxes. I lowered taxes to the lowest level in history. So we have never had a lower tax rate in the history of Miami. And I'm going to shock you with this. We've grown tremendously. Okay. So our growth has outpaced Florida's growth by 4 times, and it's outpaced the national growth by 6 times, right? We grew 12% last year. Florida grew about 3.5. And the federal government grew 2. So, you know, when you reduce taxes, you invite investment. Also, other cities across America helped us by pushing out innovators at the same exact time, like Amazon being pushed out of New York famously after winning the HQ2 prize, and Elon getting kicked out of California when a legislator said, F Elon Musk, and he replied, message received, and left.
careful what you ask for there.
Yeah, right? I did the exact opposite. Somebody put out a tweet that said, what if we move Silicon Valley to Miami? And I said, how can I help? Yeah. And the reason why I said that is because A, I recognize, and this is another part of my candidacy that's important, I recognize that the future of our economy is going to be more and more digital, whether we like it or not, right? That's going to become an increasing part of our GDP. And to be a successful president, you're going to have to pivot the country to accept and to take advantage of those opportunities. I've done that. I think I'm the only candidate that's done that successfully on a major ecosystem. We are now, as you said, we're number one in the nation in wage growth in the city. We have the lowest unemployment in America, and we've created thousands of high-paying jobs, right, that are going to project successfully into the next generation because they are digital jobs from the knowledge-based economy that we know is going to dominate the next generation. So I think those are two major reasons why I'm running and why I think I'm uniquely qualified. I think the third is, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, is immigration, which – you know, the southern border is a disaster, both as a human trafficking crisis and as a fentanyl crisis. We're not managing it as if it's a crisis, number one. Number two, you've got China that we're giving $1 trillion of our wealth on an annual basis approximately. They're using that to subvert us in our hemisphere and create poverty, which is creating more immigration pressure. I think as a Hispanic Republican president, be in a good position to negotiate some of the hard issues related to the illegal undocumented that are in our country. And then I think we've got a right-sized legal immigration. One of the things nobody talks about, and I don't understand why no one talks about this, is how do we peg legal immigration, which everyone is in favor of, right? A legal and orderly immigration system to metrics that are objective, right? So that we don't get into this whole debate, right? Like, for example, unemployment, like the need for skilled and unskilled labor in different parts of the country. And the fact that we have a declining birth rate. Those are objective metrics that we can peg legal immigration to. And what I think a lot of American workers want is they just want a level playing field. They don't want people that are coming into this country that are getting paid under the table or are not getting paid W-2 when they're getting paid W-2 and they have to pay payroll taxes and they have to pay Social Security, right? And they feel that it's unfair. So I look, they know that sometimes they need help. They know that sometimes they need employees. They just want them to be on a level playing field.
Do you know, I've thought about this for a long time, and I've been in politics for a while. Democrats, speaking of illegal immigration, Democrats seem to think, and I think they're completely wrong, and I think the data shows that they're wrong, they seem to think that if they're talking to Hispanic voters specifically, and they just say in a scary voice, immigration and Republicans, that that's the end of the argument and they think that they win. But, you know, we, and you can speak to this a lot more, a lot better than I can, but it seems to me that my, in my, and this is anecdotal information, but if you talk to legal immigrants, those, or their people who maybe their ancestors had been legal immigrants. And if you ask them, do you think that other people should have to follow the rules like you or your ancestors did? They say, hell yeah, they should follow the rules like we did. And so the Democrats have this completely backwards, don't they, politically?
100%. And I think that, I mean, it goes so much further than that, but yes, you're 100% right on that. I think part of the reason why, you know, having a Hispanic Republican potential president dealing with the undocumented illegals that are in this country, you've got to respect those that did it right, that followed the process, that were law abiding, that waited in line, right? That, so, you know, it's respect for those people. So that's a major issue. I think the second part that you didn't mention, which I'll mention, is, you know, Democrats have been messaging Hispanics or Latinos completely inappropriately, right? First, they started with Latinx, right? Which is this sort of monolithic brand that nobody feels connected to, right? Like, I don't know what a Latinx is, you know?
Then Joe Biden goes out and says Latinx. He doesn't even know what that word is.
No way.
Then you have Joe Biden, who goes to a rally and says, or a speech, and you know somebody wrote this for her. She says, you know, that Hispanics are as unique as the bodegas of New York, the blossoms of Miami, and the tacos of San Antonio.
So bad. And you're like, so bad.
So, I think Republicans have been given a gift. And Tim, you sort of highlighted this. If we can go with a pro-family, pro-law and order, but then also come up with some solutions to how do we deal with this issue long-term and respect the nuances of different Hispanic cultures, like the Democrats have disrespected them, then I think you have a great opportunity to expand one of what I call three major buckets to the generational viability of the Republican Party. I think the three major buckets are Hispanics, which are 20% of the country, right? 7% registered Republican, 11% registered Democrat. You've got young voters. I mean, it's unconscionable that a voter 30 and under is voting 26 points plus for Biden. That's unconscionable. That cannot happen. I was just at Turning Point yesterday, and I'll tell you that it's exciting to see young conservatives. You know what I mean? What Charlie has done with a lot of these young conservatives is exciting. So I think we've got to change that delta. And then one where I think is, I'm in a unique position, and I have a track record on this, is urban areas or cities, right? Cities are all blue. I mean, most of the big cities are blue across America. When I got elected, my county, my community was blue, right? And I enacted a series of legislative proposals that were simple, that were conservative, right? Low taxes, increased safety, and lean into innovation and create the atmosphere for high-paying jobs. By the way, I don't feel like government does that. I just think government sometimes either gets out of the way, or what we do from a branding perspective is we invite people, particularly, it's like know your customer and care for your customer, right? We appreciate our customers while other places don't. Mm-hmm. And that very basic formula of keep taxes low, keep people safe, and lean into innovation, right? That is a model for American city success. And if we do that, we're going to get the kinds of results that we got in Miami, where we pushed the envelope plus 40 for Republicans. That may not happen in every single city, but if you go plus 20 or plus 10 or plus 15, think about the numbers, the sheer numbers of that, right? Yeah. At scale. And when you think the last two presidential elections have been decided by less than 100,000 votes nationally, and obviously understanding that there's an electoral college and there's all these swing states and all that, but having those three buckets, young voters, urban voters, and Hispanic voters all go to the Republican Party, I think could create not just a win in 24, but a generation of wins.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you just mentioned going to Turning Point yesterday, and I was watching some of the clips that you posted on Twitter, which were amazing. You had a lot of great one-liners in there. But I wanted to ask you about your campaign as a whole. I know you've been traveling around. What are you seeing on the ground? What are people saying to you? What's kind of setting your campaign apart?
Well, look, I think we're all traveling, all the candidates. I think what's interesting is there's a, and this always happens. I mean, when I ran for mayor, this is the same issue. When I ran for commissioner, same issue. There's a difference between what the media wants to talk about and sort of what I call Washington speak, right? Mm-hmm. And what regular people want to talk about. And there's no surprise to me on that, right? Like, I've dealt with that my whole political career. There's always a delta between what sells, right? Like, what's exotic for the press to continue to push, which is often their obsession with the former president, mm-hmm. right? And what regular people want to talk about. Regular people want to talk about, how are you going to make life better for me, right? How are you going to make life better for my kids? Mm-hmm. How are you going to deal with issues? Like, for example, I was in New Hampshire on Friday, and you know, they have a major homeless and major fentanyl crisis. So the fentanyl that's coming in large waves through our southern border is affecting places as far in the northeast as New Hampshire, right? So this is the impact that having a porous border has on our country. Right. It's not just about immigration. It's also about the 80 to 90,000 Americans that are dying of fentanyl overdoses. Mm. And that's the equivalent of a 747 crashing every single day. And we're not treating the border with that equivalent crisis. Right. Like if a 747 crashed one day. Right. We had a submersible with five people that imploded. It was a national tragedy. Right. If we were to treat the border like that was happening, we would solve the border in one day, right?
Right.
So it's unfortunate. Homelessness is a major issue. Urban crime is a major issue, in addition to, of course, unaffordability through inflation, which has been propagated by this administration through Bidenomics, which is socialism by a different name. Reengineering, social reengineering, a government as the answer to all problems, you know, which is insane.
It is insane. Yeah, you've mentioned the media a couple times here, and MSNBC had a column, maybe you saw it, had a column last week, maybe. Sunny, when was that? We were just talking about it.
It might have been 2 weeks ago.
Where talking about how staying fit is an alt-right, and it's a far-right thing now.
So crazy.
Of course, they bring up Hitler because Hitler promoted boxing and jujitsu or something, which is insane. And you, I know, are very fit. I saw on Twitter you were bragging about your 5K time and, you know, daring any of the other candidates to match your 5K time. So obviously you're a crazy right-winger if you dare to be in shape, right? That's the opposite.
You know, it's so sad, Tim. It's so sad because, you know, it's a disrespect to the policy implications of being fit. And what do I mean by that? Okay, so let's talk about two things, addiction and mass shootings. Let's take those two things, those two issues. When you look at addiction and mass shootings, both of them, well, mass shootings relate back oftentimes to a mental health crisis, right? Mm-hmm. And addiction is a dependency crisis, right? It's a chemical dependency crisis, right? So let's unpack what is exercising, what is sleeping, what is eating. Why is that important to like regular human beings, right? It's important because let's say you work out in a gym or in a community, and I'll talk a little bit about this initiative that I put together as president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. I was president of all the mayors in the country, right? You're in community, so you're not lonely, right? So you have, you know, one of the biggest factors in mental health crises is loneliness, mm-hmm. right? You're in a community. Number two, I do CrossFit, but it doesn't have to be CrossFit. It could be any other exercise. You're building resistance. When you do exercise, by its very nature, it's resistance training. Mm-hmm. You are training yourself to be more resilient, right? More resilient to adversity. The adversity in that case is the weight training, right? And in this world, we are educating young children and men and women without the adversity and resiliency skills they need to survive in an everyday world, in a tough world. Right? The world can be tough. And so what happens is if you don't have those resiliency skills, how do you cope with adversity? How do you cope with anxiety? Maybe you try an opioid. Maybe you try fentanyl, right? And that stimulates you in a synthetic way that you would otherwise get from working out. Well, everybody knows when you work out, you get endorphins, you get dopamine, you get all these great chemicals, which frankly are the same exact chemicals that these pharmaceuticals produce. The only difference is it's not healthy, right? Mm-hmm. You're gonna chase this high as opposed to doing something that's good for you. So the fact that everything in the liberal world, you know, gets put into this prism of hyper masculinity or, you know, hyper toxicity or all this nonsense, right? I mean, it just, you know, they're trying to redefine who we are, you know, who men are, who women are, you know, every single aspect of our society they're trying to re-engineer. And, you know, it's sad because the consequences of that re-engineering are pretty clear. And it's hurting a lot of people at scale. And, you know, for us, I'm blessed. My parents have been married for 47 years. I've been married, about to go on my 16-year marriage anniversary. I have three younger sisters, all married. My wife's parents have been married. Look, we're blessed, right? Her sisters, her siblings, all married. She's the oldest of four as well. So we're very blessed. Part of the reason why I can run for president is because I have so much stability in my household. And my wife is so supportive, and I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and she's able to make sure that all their needs are met, right? So I don't understand how this gets confused and convoluted. But when you look at, for example, socialist countries, right? And there are so many in the world right now, they try to strip away all that individuality. They try to strip away the family. They try to strip away your religious beliefs. They try to strip away your right to speak freely. And what do they substitute in its place? The state.
Yep.
Government.
Yep. Well, you just mentioned the left kind of trying to reinvent what a man is, what a woman is, saying that we're interchangeable. Can you talk to me a little bit about the culture war that we're facing right now? Do you think that we are losing our culture war to the left, or how do we stand up to it?
Yeah. So I think for 40 years or so in my lifetime, the conservative right has been pummeled, right, by a media that is incredibly liberal. By the way, liberal trying to say they're objective, right? So for 40 years, they were liberal under the guise of objective. I think the beauty of this moment is they've been exposed, right? Like, they are liberal and they admit that they're liberal, okay? And this media moment, right, where you have podcasting like this, where you have, 24-hour news cycles and a variety of news stations, where you have all these different platforms, has allowed the right to push back for the first time, I think, in my lifetime, right? And then, of course, you do see that elections matter. Look, and you have to give the former president credit because he nominated Supreme Court justices that are faithful to the Constitution. And are not trying to be judicial activists. So I think that obviously matters. So who you pick as president matters from that perspective. And you're starting to see a total pushback from the right and say, hey, look, we used to be the silent majority. We used to kind of like have to tiptoe around some of these things. We don't have to do that anymore. We can be unabashed about our positions. And we know we're going to get that support. So I think, you know, that is true. I also think that, you know, our conversation generally is extremely toxic. You know what I mean? Just generally. And I do hear this, by the way, when we were asking the earlier question about what do you hear when you go to some of these states, you do hear a lot about the toxicity of the conversation and the desire to want to reframe it a little bit into something more positive and more unifying.
You, a couple of times you've mentioned socialism during that answer and the previous one. And I think, from my perspective, you know, your personal story is a large part of, you know, your introduction to voters and why you believe the things that you believe. First generation American, your parents fled Cuba, right? Do I have that right? And the other day, as I mentioned, I was on a cruise with my family and my two little boys, who are now 5 and almost 7. And we were sort of circumnavigating the island of Cuba on our way to Jamaica and Grand Cayman. And there was a period of time where we could see Cuba off in the distance from the ship. And they were asking me, what is that? Is that where we're going? And I said, no, that's not where we're going. then I tried to explain just like from what I understand. Obviously, I've never been there and I've never experienced it. What life is like from Cuba. And these are two little boys and they don't quite understand. But that's a major part of what drives you to public service, I would imagine, and why you are so passionately proud of America. Can you talk a little bit about that, what your parents' experience was and what led you to the point where you're at because of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Tim. Look, that's about as close as I've ever come to seeing Cuba, to being in Cuba as well. I've seen it sort of off in the distance from planes that are flying by. It's very personal for me. and for my family. My grandfather was in a Cuban jail. He was jailed by Castro. His brother, Ignacio, died in a Cuban jail. My dad tells me the story of visiting my father in jail with my mother, with my grandmother, I'm sorry, who was you know, the mother of 14 kids. My dad was the ninth of 14. And he remembers seeing her put her fingers through the bars to touch fingers with my grandfather, and not knowing whether they would see him again, whether he would be freed, whether he would be alive. Obviously, his brother ended up dying. The communists in Cuba follow a very predictable model that we see throughout the history of communism, which is they take power. It's absolute. They punish people they perceive to be oppositional to them. They start taking away, like I said, all the individuality. They create equality, which is what they promise to the people. They create equality. They create equal misery and equal poverty for everybody.
Right.
Okay. And the problem is that it's the easiest sell in politics. If you tell someone, hey, I'm going to make you equal. I'm going to take away from the rich people and I'm going to spread it out equally so that everybody has more, right? It's such an easy argument. It just never works, and it's never worked. And all it does is create destitution, despair, desperation. And part of the biggest reasons why we have an immigration issue in our country, it's because first, we're the greatest country on the planet. But secondly, it's because the leaders of these countries have been systematically depriving those countries of opportunities. And then they've been helped by our foreign enemies. So, it's no wonder. I mean, just think about what it would take. I always tell people this. Think about what it would take for you today to decide that tomorrow you're going to get in a makeshift little raft, okay? And you're going to put yourself and possibly your family, and you're going to try to navigate 90 miles in the Gulf Stream, shark-infested waters, to try to make it to the United States of America. Just think about how desperate you have to be. I mean, you guys are, you're in a nice studio, Tim, Sunny, it looks like you may be in your house or your apartment. Just think about what it would take to tomorrow. You wake up in the morning, you go, okay, tomorrow I'm starting this journey.
Yeah.
It's almost unfathomable to us. And it just goes to show how brutal these dictatorships are, and how far these people are willing to go to never lose power. And we as Americans have to understand that this is real, and this can come to, and is in a certain variation coming to a lot of our cities in America right now, right? Because there is a notion, and it's propagated a lot by these liberal people in the press, that government is the answer to all problems. Just keep increasing taxes, which is, by the way, part of the reason why Miami is doing so well, right? As New York is, people are paying 54% taxes in New York and 50% taxes in California. There's no state income tax, and we've reduced property taxes to the lowest level in history.
Wow. Mr. Mayor, you have such a powerful story when it comes to socialism and having firsthand experience with that. And it makes me very frustrated with my generation, because they hear these socialist policies and think, oh, it's so wonderful, life's so great for everyone. But what they need to do is they need to hear stories like yours, like your grandparents, so they can really understand that, no, nothing about socialism is good for everyone. But I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you about your, go ahead.
If I could just say one thing real quick, just look at Hollywood, mm-hmm. right? They do these things, the Motorcycle Diaries, where they romanticize Che Guevara. Che Guevara was a brutal assassin. Argentinian who went to Cuba and was eventually killed by the CIA sponsored operation. But I mean, these guys are brutal. And then you look at, you know, Sound of Freedom, which is a movie about, you know, a CIA agent who goes off and saves a young girl. And the liberal media, again, says that it's like a QAnon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy the kind of brainwashing that goes on for young people.
That's exactly what it is brainwashing, especially on social media when you see it just glorified and praised. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you really quick about your two fellow Floridians, President Trump and Ron DeSantis. What do you think about their campaigns?
Well, I think obviously the former president's running a great campaign. I mean, I don't think anybody can dispute that objectively, right? He's over 50% in the national polls, and he seems to be doing well in the state polls, including in Florida, where he seems to be beating the governor by plus 20. So right now, if he's in the driver's seat, right? Like, if it were up to him, he would probably wish his January 8th couldn't come any sooner, which is the Iowa caucus. Mm-hmm. Because if he were in the same position on January 8th that he is today, he's going to be the nominee of the party, because he'll win New Hampshire, where he's actually even has a bigger lead against the governor, and then South Carolina and so on and so forth. The momentum would just be so big at that point. So I think the challenge for any candidate that's not him is, how do you break out between now and January 8th, right? And so what I've said is, look, I think the candidates that are not the former president are known, but what I would consider unexciting. Hmm. And I want to be exciting, right? Like, as a proposition. And my
issue, hold on. You don't think Asa Hutchinson is exciting?
I'm not gonna call out any one person.
Okay.
Thank you, Tim, for trying to get me to make the virality here.
But, all right, I'm sorry.
It's okay. For me, I want to be exciting, and I need to get known, right? And mm-hmm. so that starts, hopefully, at the debate on August 23rd. That's what I'm spending my time and energy. That's why I have my website behind me. I ask people, look, whether you like me or not, whether you want to vote for me or not, just donate $1 to my campaign at francissuarez.com. We did this really cool thing with Leo Messi on the 21st. He has his first game. And we're giving away 2 front row tickets. So we're asking people to Venmo $1 at Suarez 2024. And so, you know, I started kind of late, so I have to raise the 50,000 or 40,000 contributions quicker than the other candidates. So we're getting creative, like a lot of other candidates are getting creative, right? But I think for me, it's about having time to tell my story. And then the beauty of this country, and Tim, you said this, and I'm so glad that you said this, because we are shaped. I am very much shaped by my origin. There's no doubt about it. The beauty of this country is you get to choose your leaders. How many countries around the world don't have that right? So, you know, what my view in getting into this race was saying, I want to give people an honest opportunity to choose someone that maybe looks different, sounds different, has a different background, has these good credentials, has this good vision for the future. Will that ultimately break through in today's modern day? Obviously, nobody knows, right? Like, you go in with the best of intentions. You go in with a sincere desire to serve. And then the chips fall where they may, right? You know, and you know this, Tim, from your work in politics for a long time, which is oftentimes success and failure is defined by things that you don't control.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And you could say, you know, you could use the former president as a great example. If anybody would have told you day one when he came down the escalators that he was going to be the president of the United States, I don't care who you are. Nobody really believed. He may have believed it in his heart, but I don't think anybody, I'm not even sure he believed it.
On that day, I did not believe it on that day, I can tell you.
Yeah. Listen, it's not even a disrespect to him to say that. It's just, that was not the conventional wisdom of the moment, right? You had a variety of other people that were running that were well-funded, you know, and so that's what happened.
So one way for you to break through, for any candidate to break through who's trying to, and I think it's more accurate to say, you know, Ron DeSantis wants it to be a two-man race, DeSantis and Trump, but it's more like Trump against the field, really.
I think that's right.
Because DeSantis has fallen back to the pack. So there is, I think, the opportunity for someone to break out. And one way to do that is to get on the debate stage, as you said. And you are doing, because the RNC has requirements now. It's what, 40,000 donors and certain things in the polls and all that. Yeah. But the 40,000 donors are something that's where you've just mentioned you're being creative. There's the Messi tickets to Messi's first game in Miami. And then didn't you have one with college tuition?
Well, right. That's, I think, a super PAC that's supporting.
Oh, that's not you.
That's a super PAC. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about why it would be important to get on the debate stage, because I think at Turning Point the other day, you did say, look, there's not a whole lot of difference between all the candidates here policy-wise, so there's not a whole lot of contrast, but it's about execution, right? If you get on the debate stage, what's your strategy? What's your message?
I think it's twofold. I think one of them is convincing voters that I'm the best person to take them into this uncertain economic future, right? I think if you really, really look at what voters care about, most of the time it's pocketbook issues, right? They care about, you know, what they're paying at the grocery store. They care about their children's future prosperity. And voters got to ask themselves, who is the best person to do that, right? So I think that we have a compelling story to tell. I think the second part is, you know, who is the candidate that can create a majority for Republicans for a generation, right? And I think I also have the personality, the background, and the focus on those three buckets that I think are buckets that could be transformational for the party. So that's going to be the message. It's oftentimes, as you can imagine, Tim, it's not about getting complicated. It's about being simple, about delivering your message clearly, about being articulate. Obviously, running for president, you're going to take shots and people are going to take shots at you. And so you have to show to the American people that you're able to handle that, that you're able to parlay, that you're able to push back when necessary. I think that's important. And sometimes voters will say, hey, that's important. But I can tell you in the focus groups that we've done, there are some candidates in this field, and don't make me tell you who, but there are some candidates in this field that the more they get to know them, the less they like them. And there are some candidates in this field that the more they get to know them, the more they like them. And so I want to be in that category. I think based on the focus groups I've seen and the people I've met, I feel like I'm in that category. The more people get to know me, if I get to the debate stage and I got millions of people listening to my vision, my goals, my concrete, the things I've done, not the things I want to do, the things I've actually done. I think that that's going to continue to give me oxygen. It's going to continue to give me volume. And like I said, I think I'm an exciting candidate. What I want to be is a known and exciting candidate. If I'm a known and exciting candidate, that's where you have a real opportunity to grow in that alternative category, as you call it.
Okay. Well, Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, tell us where folks can find you online and social media.
So right behind me, you see francissuarez.com. I'm asking people to donate a dollar so that I can get on the debate stage and keep having this conversation, keep talking about the future of our country, which is what we should all be focused on, trying to make the conversation as positive and as constructive as possible. And then if you want to potentially vie for Messi tickets for the front row, you know, we'd ask you to make a donation at Suarez 2024. That's by Venmo, at Suarez 2024. That's going to be, those tickets are going to be given away in the next few days in anticipation of the July 21st game. We had a really cool thing last night where we unveiled him. It was sort of like, I don't know if you remember when Chris Bosh and LeBron joined Dwayne Wade and we did that a big unveiling. We had one of those yesterday. It rained a little bit, but we had a good one for Messi. It was a lot of fun.
That was great. Well, Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami in the great state of Florida, thank you very much for your time running for president, of course, and we appreciate you stopping by. It was a great conversation.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Great to meet you.